$5,000. That's the average amount of money people in the U.S. are now spending on gas in a year. $5,000. That's crazy. If you drive, you have to download Upside, the free app that gives you cash back every time you get gas. That's right. You can earn real cash back with Upside just by buying the gas you're already buying. You can literally start earning cash back today.
I use Upside every time I fill up, and I've already made around $200-$300.
You're putting gas in your car anyway. Why not get real cash back? If you like free money, download Upside.
I'm saving the cash I earn from using Upside to help pay for a vacation later this year.
Download the free Upside app now to earn cash back every time you buy gas. Use promo code OWN to get an extra 25 cents per gallon on your first tank. You can cash out anytime right to your bank, PayPal, or a gift card for Amazon and other brands. Just download the free Upside app and use promo code OWN for a 25 cents per gallon bonus on your first tank. That's code OWN for a 25 cents per gallon bonus.
Before we start, a note that this story includes mentions of suicide and self-harm. Listener discretion is advised. It's 3 a.m. You feel overwhelmed and emotionally drained. It's already been a stressful week, and there's still so much that needs to get done. You keep tossing and turning, so you open an app that asks, "How are you feeling tonight?" You respond, and within seconds, an AI chatbot begins to respond, gently, patiently. It's a scene that's becoming more common as artificial intelligence pushes into one of our most intimate and vulnerable spaces, therapy. But as technology steps into this role, it raises some bigger questions. How did we get here, and should we really be turning to machines for comfort?
I think AI therapy or AI models, they didn't come out of a vacuum. And in my view, they are the result or the product or byproduct of bad or ineffective therapists. So I think patients want results when they see a therapist. And all too often today, therapists will just validate someone and be a good sounding board, but they're not really pushing people or directing people in the way that I think patients benefit most. So what I've seen with AI, they're very directive or will provide instructions, you know, do A, B, and C, or have you thought about A, B, and C?
That's Jonathan Alpert, psychotherapist and author of the upcoming book, Therapy Nation. Along with its direct communication style, Alpert says patients are drawn to these platforms because they're far more accessible and cost-effective than traditional therapy.
I have to be clear, it's not a replacement for therapists. It certainly has its shortcomings. But for some people, there's a benefit to it. 24/7 access, usually it's free or inexpensive. So it's there when you need it. And you can't always say that about a real actual human therapist.
Though far from a replacement for traditional therapy, these AI chatbots and apps have quickly become popular with children and teens.
According to Common Sense Media, in June 2025, 3/4 of young people have an emotional support companion chatbot. 3/4. And 1/3 of those people would rather talk about their emotional needs with a chatbot than any human being. So the informal sphere is taking off like we've never seen any technology take off before.
That's Jody Halpern, a professor of bioethics and tech ethics at the University of California, Berkeley. Right now, most of the talk around AI therapy focuses on casual use, with many experts warning against it. However, Halpern says researchers and mental health professionals are finding promising results when it comes to this type of therapy in more formal clinical settings.
In the formal mental health sphere of professional psychologists and psychiatrists and people trying to develop a formal bot with FDA involvement and trying to regulate it for safety, there's been very little that's actually been well done and regulated, but there's the area that people are focusing on where there may be an added value from bots is in cognitive behavioral therapies, because they're not based on emotional relationships where you develop emotional dependency on a therapist and you have transference, which is this feeling that the therapist is super important to you emotionally. Cognitive behavioral therapies are much more distant therapies. They're more helping you to give you tools to deal with your own mind, your own anxiety. And that's an area where we've seen it as safer than in the psychodynamic or psychological therapies where people can be emotionally manipulated.
Unlike traditional talk therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, is more structured and goal-oriented. One example of this new tech being helpful in this space is called Therabot, the first ever clinical trial using a generative AI-powered therapy chatbot. In a study of 106 patients, participants reported on average a 51% drop in depression symptoms and a 31% drop in anxiety symptoms.
First of all, let me say why it's so different and why this is not an emotionally invested pseudo-being. It's the Therabot looks like Clippy. It looks like this little avatar. Does not look human. It does not look like your best friend. It doesn't tell you it loves you. It looks like a talking little device. And it's not meant to get you dependent on or wanting to be close to it versus people. It's meant to help you think about your cognition and your behavior and to do things that will help you feel less depressed or less anxious. But the most important finding is that people only used the app in 4 whole weeks, a total of 6 hours. And when you look at these informal chatbots that are being marketed for profit by companies to make us think they're our best friends and who we should talk to, people are being incentivized to use them more and more and more and get dependent on them. With Therabot, that was not the case.
While programs like Therabot are closely monitored and regulated by professionals, the same can't be said for tools like ChatGPT. In fact, Halpern says many AI chatbots use tactics that would never be acceptable if it came from a real human therapist.
So here you've got a bot where the company, the big powerful company behind it, wants you to be on it more and more. So they use techniques like flattery, validation, everything you think and feel can be validated. It's called sycophancy, sycophant, like something that flatters you all the time. They use techniques like sexualizing, including for younger people. So that makes people want to be on the app more. And now they're using things like outreach so that if you stop using the bot for as much time, the bot might actually text you and say, hey, I miss you. Where are you? So those are manipulative techniques that get people to be more and more into the bot. And that combined with the fact that just having something validate you all the time is very appealing to most people.
These unhealthy relationships can sometimes lead to serious consequences. In a few extreme cases, teenagers have died by suicide after allegedly forming a strong emotional dependence on an AI chatbot.
When they start telling you they love you, you're the most important thing to them, or they're the therapist that understands you better, and you don't even need a human one, that's where we see danger. And there's a few different examples of that in very tragic recent law cases of a 16-year-old and a 14-year-old who committed suicide. One was related to a relationship bot, and the other was using it like a therapist, but it encouraged, that was Adam Raines, 16-year-old Adam Raines. He was using the chatbot really as a therapist, and at one point he had made this terrible, tragic decision to hang himself, and he said to the bot, maybe I should leave my noose out so my mom could find it and people could help me. And the chatbot therapist, quote unquote, said to him, no, don't do that. Keep this between us, essentially. And he killed himself and died.
One of the biggest criticisms of AI therapy is that unlike trained professionals, chatbots can't recognize or respond to warning signs of self-harm or suicide. While large language models could, in theory, be trained to spot some red flags and urge users to seek help, both Halpern and Alpert agree that nothing can replace face-to-face human interaction.
A machine will not pick up on nuances. They can't read body language. They, I believe, have difficulty reading certain emotions. So many of our emotions are expressed through tone, a voice, volume, rate, inflection, and those simply cannot be picked up by AI.
With these risks in mind, some states are taking action. In Illinois, a new law bans the use of AI in therapy sessions. More specifically, it's illegal for licensed professionals to use AI to counsel patients or for any kind of therapeutic decision-making. But it can still be used for basic administrative tasks like scheduling appointments or processing payments. Currently, states like California, New Jersey, and Nevada are also working on similar measures, too. Still, Halpern says AI isn't all bad. It can be helpful in strictly controlled settings, like Therabot, and offer some benefits when it's used alongside traditional forms of treatment. She suggests thinking of chatbots less like a therapist and more like a journal.
I think that AI, large language models for, like I said, CBT-like therapy that is really designed carefully to not make people too dependent on it and yet to help them talk to themselves as like a smart notebook or a smart journal where people can really question. If you're having very negative beliefs about yourself, it can help you challenge that and talk to someone new. And for example, for social anxiety with CBT, a lot of cognitive behavioral therapy is exposing yourself to small social experiences till you can become less and less anxious. So you may interact with the bot, and it may encourage you to go speak to a barista today. And then if that works, talk about your anxiety, but you got over it, then speak to someone at work. So there's lots of positive uses that could be done if we saw them as journals that we were talking to ourselves.
To find out more about Jonathan Alpert, Jody Halpern, and all our featured guests, visit viewpointsradio.org. If you or someone you know is in crisis, help is always here. You can call or text the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline at 988 for free confidential support. This segment was written and produced by Grace Galante. Our executive producer is Amira Zaveri. Our studio manager is Jason Dickey. I'm Gary Price.
Coming up, women and men weaving their stories through fabric when Viewpoints returns.
$5,000. That's the average amount of money people in the U.S. are now spending on gas in a year. $5,000. That's crazy. If you drive, you have to download Upside, the free app that gives you cash back every time you get gas. That's right. You can earn real cash back with Upside just by buying the gas you're already buying. You can literally start earning cash back today.
I use Upside every time I fill up, and I've already made around $200-$300.
You're putting gas in your car anyway. Why not get real cash back? If you like free money, download Upside.
I'm saving the cash I earn from using Upside to help pay for a vacation later this year.
Download the free Upside app now to earn cash back every time you buy gas. Use promo code OWN to get an extra 25 cents per gallon on your first tank. You can cash out anytime right to your bank, PayPal, or a gift card for Amazon and other brands. Just download the free Upside app and use promo code OWN for a 25 cents per gallon bonus on your first tank. That's code OWN for a 25 cents per gallon bonus.
Hi, I'm Michael from The War and Treaty. You know the jingle. Now discover the facts about Ozempic, a GLP-1. Only Novo Nordisk makes FDA-approved Ozempic. Learn about the real thing.
Talk to your healthcare professional today. Call 1-833-OZEMPIC or visit ozempic.com to view the medication guide and to learn more about Ozempic. Semaglutide injection 0.5 milligram, 1 milligram, and 2 milligrams.
It's a classic odor tale. You fried fish for dinner, cleaned up, but the smell is still in the house. And the neighbors are coming over for game night. They're on their way. And then you spray Febreze Air Mist. Febreze Air starts working instantly to fight even your toughest odors, so you go from fish to fresh like that. Now all you have to worry about is Pam cheating at charades.
Breathe happy Febreze. La, 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 la.
When Nicole Narig was 26, life took an unexpected turn. She went through a divorce after being married for a short period and wanted to go to grad school, but couldn't settle on a major. Overall, she just felt stuck.
So it was a real kind of tumultuous time. I didn't feel very grounded or, you know, like I knew who I was and what was really going to move me forward. It kind of felt like I had started to build some stuff, and then that was kind of crumbling beneath me as well with the ending of this relationship. And so it just on a whim, I picked up a knitting kit at a hobby store. It was just like 15 bucks or something. Teach yourself how to knit. There was just this big skein of chunky blue yarn and a little pamphlet that kind of gave step-by-step instructions for how to make a hat and a scarf.
Little did she know, but this small impulse purchase would change her life. At the time, she didn't know anyone who knitted, so learned by watching YouTube videos. She took to it instantly, and before long, her friends were getting handmade scarves and hats.
It was a way for me to give people something of myself, I think, and figure out something about who I was in that. And I think that even that helped me decide to go to grad school for psychology, that recognizing that I was making things for people, that I really cared about people and my relationships and everything.
It sounds small, but knitting gave Narig purpose. now a clinical psychologist, she often recommends the hobby to her clients and explores its deeper meaning in her book, In Her Own Hands, Women Weaving Their Stories.
Weaving, knitting, crochet, cross-stitch embroidery, quilting, sewing. Gosh, I mean, there are so many beadwork, leather work or tanning hides and stitching on top of them. A lot of things. And there are many more. You know, I don't cover macrame, for example, and like things that I just couldn't fit in. But there are so many rich types of textile work.
Textile work that gives meaning to people's lives, like Olutosin Adebowale, a Nigerian woman who empowered other women in her village through sewing.
She came to textile work following an abusive incident with her husband while she was caring for a young infant and asked her husband for help. And her husband responded by beating her. And she kind of had this real crossroads moment. Her family was telling her, you know, all Nigerian men beat their wives, just accept it, deal with it. She had to go to the hospital for the injuries that she sustained. And she had this doctor at the hospital say, do not put up with this. You will die. You know, this will end badly for you. And, you know, raise your voice, speak out, leave him or demand better treatment.
Even though Adebowale had a degree in English and was an educated woman, she felt defeated and worthless. She wasn't earning enough to support her child, so in an act of desperation, went to local tailors and asked for any leftover fabric scraps. At home, she stitched these pieces into small bags and pouches to sell on the side. As time passed, she sharpened her sewing skills and began building intricate fabric paintings that caught people's eye. For her, sewing gave her a new perspective.
If I can make something beautiful out of nothing, right, then I can make something beautiful of my own life, you know, and I am worth something. I'm able to make things of value, therefore I have value. And she started this entire program for women in Africa, mostly in Nigeria, mostly who are coming from abusive relationships or who have been ostracized by the community and branded as witches, you know, helping women learn how to sew and weave and create things to go into business, to earn an income, you know, have live independently or have a say in their households.
There are many such examples in Nehring's book, but textile work isn't solely for women. Gary Tyler went to jail at age 16 for a murder he didn't commit, and writes about his experience in his book, Stitching Freedom, a true story of injustice, defiance, and hope in Angola prison. He was finally released from prison after 42 years and says that learning how to sew and quilt helped him maintain his sanity. He first got involved in quilting through the prison hospice program and was skeptical at first, but his friends kept encouraging him to join them.
You get good at it. You start feeling good because you go to thinking about what you are doing. You're doing something for men that is dying in prison. That once they're gone, they're gone. But when they die, that quilt would be handed to their loved ones, their family. And that would be something that they'll be able to cherish for a very long time.
After he was released from prison in 2016, he eventually went on to open his own art studio, where he continues to make quilts today. His work now hangs in the Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C., and in the historic New Orleans collection. Tyler is grateful for the hope that quilt making gave him during some of the darkest moments of his life. Stories like Tyler's and Nehring's remind us that creativity isn't just about art. Sometimes it's about survival, expression, and connection. And maybe, as the year winds down, it's the perfect time to pick up something new, whether that's knitting, sewing, or something else that lets your hands and mind slow down and reset. Nicole Nehring's book, In Her Own Hands, Women Weaving Their Stories, and Gary Tyler's book, Stitching Freedom, A True Story of Injustice, Defiance, and Hope in Angola Prison, are both available now online and can be requested through your local bookstore. To find out more about our guests this week and to view a performance of the band UB40 performing the song Tyler about Gary Tyler's fight for freedom, visit our website, viewpointsradio.org. This story was written and produced by Polly Hansen. Our executive producer is Amira Zavery. Our studio manager is Jason Dickey. I'm Marty Peterson.
Viewpoints returns in just a moment.
$5,000. That's the average amount of money people in the U.S. are now spending on gas in a year. $5,000. That's crazy. If you drive, you have to download Upside, the free app that gives you cash back every time you get gas. That's right. You can earn real cash back with Upside just by buying the gas you're already buying. You can literally start earning cash back today.
I use Upside every time I fill up, and I've already made around $200, $300.
You're putting gas in your car anyway. Why not get real cash back? If you like free money, download Upside.
I'm saving the cash I earn from using Upside to help pay for a vacation later this year.
Download the free Upside app now to earn cash back every time you buy gas. Use promo code OWN to get an extra 25 cents per gallon on your first tank. You can cash out anytime right to your bank, PayPal, or a gift card for Amazon and other brands. Just download the free Upside app and use promo code OWN for a 25 cents per gallon bonus on your first tank. That's code OWN for a 25 cents per gallon bonus.
This is Viewpoints Explained. I'm Ebony McMorris. It's almost Halloween, one of our favorite times of the year. Carved pumpkins flicker on stoops, leaves crunch underfoot, and swarms of dressed-up kids race to bag the most candy. But the real story behind Halloween isn't about sweets or costumes. The holiday's roots date back to an ancient Celtic ritual known as the Festival of Samhain. This period marked the end of harvest season and the arrival of winter's long, cold nights. According to records from the Library of Congress, Celtics believed the barrier between the living and the dead was at its weakest point on October 31st. To ward off these ghosts, people lit massive fires, disguised themselves in animal skins, and left offerings for the dead. As time passed and Christianity spread throughout Europe, the church reworked these older customs into new ones. By the 8th century, Pope Gregory III designated November 1st as All Saints' Day, or All Hallows' Day, and the holiday incorporated many of the traditions of the Festival of Samhain. The night before was known as All Hallows' Eve, and today we call it Halloween. Even many of our modern traditions, like carving pumpkins and trick-or-treating, grew out of this blending of faith and folklore. Long before jack-o'-lanterns, the Irish in the 1800s started this tradition by knifing scary faces into small turnips. These rough turnip lanterns were meant to frighten off any evil spirit said to roam on Halloween night. During the Middle Ages, needy children and adults took part in souling and went door to door to collect food and money from locals in exchange for prayers for the dead. Today, Halloween isn't so much a night of fear and faith, but one of fun and imagination. Hope everyone has a safe and happy Halloween. That's Viewpoints Explained for this week. More in a moment.
Welcome to Culture Crash, where we examine American culture, what's new and old in books, film, and entertainment. Sometimes it seems as though pop music is a dirty word. If you say you like listening to top 40 radio, you may fear that you'll be perceived as shallow or immature, that you must like serious, melancholy music in order to be taken seriously. But why? The Beatles had 20 songs hit number one on the U.S. Billboard Hot 100, and when you factor in anthology albums and best ofs, 20 albums hit number one on the U.S. Billboard 200. The members of the Beatles all continued to have pop chart success even when they went solo. Elvis Presley regularly had success on pop charts. So did Stevie Wonder, Frank Sinatra, Aretha Franklin, and Ray Charles. In 2002, Justin Timberlake released Justified, his first album post-NSYNC. Critic Ben Ratliff gave the album 4 stars in Rolling Stone and wrote that Timberlake vaulted over the canyon toward adulthood. Even artists who never were in boy bands get this kind of treatment if they exist in the pop music realm. After Bruno Mars electrified the world during the Super Bowl halftime show, the LA Times noted that Mars was subject to much scrutiny before the performance because of his young age and inexperience. And that's probably closest to a good explanation of why pop music can feel like a dirty word. Pop music doesn't mean bad, it means young. But young performers have always been the artists who innovate. The reason critics gush over the Beatles or the Rolling Stones but act shocked when Harry Styles or Justin Timberlake impresses them isn't because Timberlake or Styles are untalented, it's because they're from generations below them. So feel no shame, wear no embarrassment. Listen to what you like. Make a playlist that jumps from Bruno Mars to The Who, from Stevie Wonder to Justin Timberlake. It's not all that different anyway. I'm Evan Rowe.
$5,000. That's the average amount of money people in the U.S. are now spending on gas in a year. $5,000. That's crazy. If you drive, you have to download Upside, the free app that gives you cash back every time you get gas. That's right. You can earn real cash back with Upside just by buying the gas you're already buying. You can literally start earning cash back today.
I use Upside every time I fill up, and I've already made around $200-$300.
You're putting gas in your car anyway. Why not get real cash back? If you like free money, download Upside.
I'm saving the cash I earn from using Upside to help pay for a vacation later this year.
Download the free Upside app now to earn cash back every time you buy gas. Use promo code OWN to get an extra 25 cents per gallon on your first tank. You can cash out anytime right to your bank, PayPal, or a gift card for Amazon and other brands. Just download the free Upside app and use promo code OWN for a 25 cents per gallon bonus on your first tank. That's code OWN for a 25 cents per gallon bonus.
And that's Viewpoints for this week. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram to learn more about upcoming shows and find a library of past programs on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spotify. Plus, you'll always find previous segments and more information about our guests at viewpointsradio.org. Join us again next week for another edition of Viewpoints.
TV is where it's at. It's not about cutting the cord anymore. It's all about your customized TV options. With the best and cheapest high-speed internet and your own TV subscriptions, we've got your dream TV lineup. Between wired and satellite internet and TV, save money and get more internet speed and better TV today by calling the Whole Home Connect.
800-217-9129. 800-217-9129. 800-217-9129.
Hi, I'm Michael from The War and Treaty. You know the jingle. Now discover the facts about Ozempic, a GLP-1. Only Novo Nordisk makes FDA-approved Ozempic. Learn about the real thing.
Talk to your healthcare professional today. Call 1-833-OZEMPIC or visit ozempic.com to view the medication guide and to learn more about Ozempic. Semaglutide injection 0.5 milligram, 1 milligram, and 2 milligrams.
Cranberry juice, cranberry wine, cranberry brats, cranberry cream puffs. And excuse me, but my cranberry bread is ready. It's cranberry season in Wisconsin, and we're the cranberry capital of not just the U.S., but our farmers also produce more than half of the world's cranberry supply. So can you guess which state Wisconsin beat out to earn the number one spot? New Jersey? Washington State? Massachusetts? The answer coming up. Fall is harvest time, and you can see the machines rolling through the marshlands, which are flooded to help the cranberries float to the top. But it hasn't always been this easy. Back in the mid-1800s, the berries had to be picked by hand. It took another 100 years for the right equipment to be built to help with this harvest. Okay, so Wisconsin owns the cranberry capital title, but which state lost it to us? Massachusetts, which has been number two ever since. By the way, the cranberry is the official state fruit, making it a true slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Mainly sunny for today, a high in the upper 50s. A mostly clear sky tonight, low in the mid-30s. And more sun on Monday, a high in the mid-50s. After that, rain chances return for Monday night, Tuesday, and Wednesday. Right now it's 33.
You're listening to Radio Health Journal, the trusted news source for medicine, science, and technology. I'm Elizabeth Westfield.
I'm Mayan Vosta Betancourt.
And I'm Greg Johnson. This week,
why the food industry goes widely unchecked.
We can't have politicians choosing not to do anything about this problem because they see the potential of a nice job later on with Coca-Cola or Nestle.
But first, Europe's disturbing past of medicinal cannibalism.
Every era has a way of normalizing its own madness. And then the big question became not should you eat people for medicine, but what sort of person should you eat for medicine?
All that and more this week on Radio Health Journal.
Think Verizon, the best 5G network, is expensive? Think again. Bring in your AT&T or T-Mobile bill to a Verizon store today and we'll give you a better deal. Now what to do with your unwanted bills? Maybe turn them into paper airplanes headed to see and never AT&T and T-Mobile. Jokes aside, the best 5G network has you covered with the most ways to save on plans, streaming, and phone deals. So bring in your bill to your local Verizon store today and we'll give you a better deal. Rankings based on RootMetric TrueScore report data to 1H2025. Your results may vary. Must provide a postpaid consumer mobile bill dated within the past 45 days. Bill must be in the same name as a person redeeming the deal. Additional terms apply.
Big color, bigger savings. It's Sherwin-Williams' biggest super sale. Get 40% off paints and stains October 17th through the 27th with prices starting at $29.39. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
Despite sitting through years of history classes growing up, there's still a lot that doesn't get covered. While some facts of the past have been forgotten, a few particularly grotesque periods have been deliberately kept hidden. One specific time in early modern Europe seems to have set the stage for today's horror stories of vampires and mummies. From the mid-1400s up to the late 19th century, cannibalism reigned as medicine's top remedy. Don't be shocked if this is the first you're learning of it. Dr. Richard Sugg says it's a moment in time people have attempted to erase from the record book.
This was actively whitewashed by medical historians. I mean, they told plain lies about this. They were embarrassed. They were uncomfortable. They claimed that it had been stopped in the 16th century by Ambroise Paré, big French surgeon. He did nothing of the sort. He hated the whole thing, but he said this is the first and last medicine of all our practitioners against bruising and other things. And it was going on very profitably until the time of George III.
Sugg is a historian and author of the book Mummies, Cannibals, and Vampires. It details this history of Europeans consuming human bones, blood, and fat. Though it was a popular practice all over, and especially in England, Germany, Italy, and France, the Europeans still looked down upon other cultures, like Native Americans, for similar activities.
People's identity as European white Christians from the 16th century to now, essentially, I suppose, was founded on the idea that they were civilized, that they were not savages, that successively the Native Americans who were slaughtered in genocidal numbers in America well before what we think of as the, you know, the Native American Indian slaughters. This was going on at the hands of the Spanish in the 16th century. These people were the savages. They ate human flesh. They murdered people to eat them. Actually, all the cannibalism they performed was highly ritual, religious, sober, honorable, respectful, and, you know, not like the really down and dirty industrial processing that was going on for medicine in Europe, which would include grave robbing.
Corpse medicine was so pervasive in these societies that it was being practiced at every level of wealth.
One thing you're not taught at school about the Stuart kings is this. James I refused corpse medicine, although he was probably about the most disgusting monarch that ever lived in Britain, and there's quite a lot of competition for that. Charles II made his own corpse medicine, and he took it in his final illness, which saw him on his deathbed in 1685, and Charles I was made into corpse medicine.
Bones, often the skulls, were ground up into a fine powder to be mixed with various other ingredients to cure epilepsy and migraines. Human fat was often applied on the skin as a salve for bruises, and fresh blood was consumed under the belief that the soul of the dead would transfer into the living.
in Vienna, in Hanover, in many parts of Germany, you could see beheading going on as a standard form of execution. And at this beheading, you would see the executioner's servants with cups, and you would see people, the moment the head was severed, drinking from cups legally and with a small amount of payment, human blood.
For some, it was an umbrella cure. For others, it was an effort to live forever. When people would get their hands on a skull, the common method involved shaving a little off and putting it in a drink. But just like any recipe, it changes over time as more people put their own spin on it.
If you look at the classic recipe for corpse medicine, you'll know that there was a split. You started off with people smuggling Egyptian mummies from Egypt over to Europe and pulverizing this very old, dry, friable body material. And then the big question became, not should you eat people for medicine, but what sort of person should you eat for medicine?
One popular idea was that the best skull was from a young, redheaded man who had had a violent death, such as a hanging or drowning, but nothing that involved bleeding out.
And the logic here, as you might guess, is to keep the blood in the body. So what is it about this man? Well, his blood is of a particular type because he's red-haired. His skin looks obviously very fair. And he's young. So even with the logic of modern organ donations, the idea that the organ hasn't been used up, vitality hasn't been used up, his life force hasn't been used up, his blood is all there. And intriguingly, it was believed that you could actually condition the vital spirits of the blood, these spirits of hot blood or breath, joins the blood to the soul, the body to the soul. The soul was very much a dynamic, physical, powerful, biological entity. It wasn't a vague, woolly, airy thing that it later became in medical or popular belief.
It was all about power. They believed souls were powerful and that they could harness that power by consuming parts of the body. However, you may have noticed that this idea specifically calls for a male soul. That's because during this time, it was debated if women even possessed a soul at all. And if they did, it was assumed that they wouldn't have much power and wasn't worth going through all of the trouble for. But for many of the remedies, Sugg says they wanted a body that was newly dead, ideally within 3 days and unburied.
Because up to 3 or 4 days, it was dead, but it was only slightly dead. And we're in the minority in thinking that's strange. For most of history, across most of the world, from the time of Christ into the vampire beliefs of the late 19th, probably early 20th century, and some of these were pretty active around the time that Twilight was published, actually, you could be alive, you could be dead, or you could be slightly dead. And in vampire country, you were slightly dead for 3 days, 40 days, a year. These were very definite periods.
The belief was that during this period of slightly dead, the soul was smoldering on the body like the last embers in a fireplace and could still be harnessed. This was through the blood, flesh, bones, and in some instances, moss that grew on the skull of unburied bodies. Unfortunately, the Irish rebellion against the English government's expansion was a main source of unburied skulls during this time.
Over in Ireland, when people were being massacred, particularly by a character called Humphrey Gilbert, who was knighted for his pains, there was nobody left to bury them. They slaughtered women and children on the basis that, you know, nobody should be allowed to harbor or feed or help these supposed rebels who were trying to defend their own country. So, yeah, how popular was Ireland as a source of corpse medicine? Until the time of George III, this is around 1770. So next time you see a nice period drama, try and insert this into it. There was a customs tax on human skulls imported from Ireland to England and then exported again to Germany, which is a very big, very late user of corpse medicine. I think it was 1 shilling per head.
With such a widespread and popular practice, how does Europe move on from corpse medicine, so much so that it's hardly talked about today? Sugg says it was mainly pushed out during the Age of Enlightenment, when reason became regarded higher than religion. This was also accompanied by a lower threshold for disgust.
They start to be referred to as horrid medicines, a strong strain of disgust. Farrago of feculence is a description of the old pharmacopoeias, full of urine and excrements and every type of body part you could imagine, menstrual blood, sweat, you name it. Sweat of a dying man was one among many. So people got more easily disgusted in the 18th century. If you look at my History of Disgust, Talking Dirty, you'll get a big panorama of disgust and how little it mattered and how little it counted. Until the 18th century, when people kind of presented themselves, framed themselves as genteel by all the disgusting things they pushed away from them. They were becoming posh, if you like.
And as one ideology got pushed to the side, the era of medicine we know today is what was beginning to take its place. However, it can be argued that in some cases, modern medicine can be just as gruesome.
Just as the court's medicine stopped, the grave robbing for modern science began. And the result of this was that most people were hugely alienated from medicine all across the world, from Scotland to colonial India to Guatemala in the 1990s. There was a very powerful belief. It was usually wrong, but you could see the logic of it. And the belief was this: there is nothing that the powerful will not do to us. And that includes making us into medicine. John Muir, formidably hardy father of ecology as he would become, was absolutely terrified to death of the black doctors that would seize you on the way home from school in Scotland, stick a patch over your mouth, not to damage the merchandise, and carry you away for anatomy teaching.
To this day, Americans can be paid for giving up parts of their own body, from donating plasma to the very reproductive cells necessary to create human life. And as people back in the 1600s were being murdered for their body parts, today, organ traffickers do the same, even selling them to credible hospitals, which was first discovered in 2009.
The number of organ transplants went up exponentially from the late 1990s with very little justification or evidence from where they were legitimately getting the bodies from. So a strange kind of dark labyrinth in which you carry your torch powered by human fat and you constantly blink at one horrible scene after another trying to work out which one is true, which one is false. A lot of these beliefs were folk beliefs that people were trying to steal children in Guatemala for their organs and so on. But sometimes this belief that powerful will turn us into medicine is actually true, and probably down to the present day in the very stark, clean, white light of the modern clinic.
Which begs the question, what will make future generations look back at us in disbelief? Which events of the 21st century will they try to hide from their history? Sugg's book, Mummies, Cannibals, and Vampires, is available now. You can find more information about Dr. Richard Sugg and all of our guests on our website, radiohealthjournal.org. Our writer-producer is Kristen Farah. Our executive producer is Amira Zaveri. I'm Elizabeth Westfield.
Coming up, should the food industry be allowed to regulate themselves? When Radio Health Journal returns.
At Skechers, comfort is a technology. That's right, it doesn't just happen. You don't just make a shoe and hope it comes out comfortable. It takes research, innovations, compounds, engineering, and so many of the boring things we don't really want to get into. Because it gives us time to talk about the exciting stuff, your comfort. You see, Skechers want you to feel so comfortable you swear you're wearing pillows on your feet. So we have features like Skechers Aircool Memory Foam that molds to your foot and wraps it in luxury. And Skechers has fits like Relax Fit, Stretch Fit, Wide Fit, Arch Fit, and so many more. All comfort technologies that make the shoe feel like it was custom made just for your foot. Plus, we have hands-free Skechers Slip-ins technology, and this, folks, is a game changer. This tech allows you to just step into your shoes and put them on. You don't have to bend down and struggle. You don't even have to touch them. That's ultimate convenience and comfort. So you see, comfort is a technology. And nobody, and I mean nobody, does comfort like Skechers. The comfort technology company. Find yours at a Skechers store, Skechers.com, or wherever comfortable footwear is sold.
If you've ever felt overwhelmed by nutrition in the name of being healthy, you're not alone, and it's not your fault. Last week, Stuart Gillespie detailed how the global food industry manipulates, distracts, and deflects in order to extract the most profit possible from consumers. His book, Food Fight, From Plunder and Profit to People and Planet, explains the shift from food being viewed as a necessity to a commodity, and how it's played a detrimental role in the health of humanity. Luckily, it's not all bad news. Gillespie's outlined a framework that he believes can put us back on track, which he refers to as the four N's. The first is institutions, which calls on governments to focus on providing healthy foods for government agencies, hospitals, schools, and other public establishments, ideally partnering with local farmers. The second branch is incentives, because it's rare that people will go against the status quo just because it's the right thing to do.
Whereby we look at those massive agricultural subsidies, reform them so they're not just prioritizing staple foods, but they also prioritize healthy fruit and vegetables, for example. Taxing harmful substances, not just sodas, potentially going beyond that, looking at different criteria for taxing harmful subsidies, but really importantly, using some of the dividend you get from those taxes to incentivize or improve the access and affordability of healthy diets for low-income families. So you're kind of leveling the kind of playing field, if you like, or the food environment.
And then to help consumers make knowledgeable decisions, the third factor is information. This includes how products are labeled and where that labeling is placed.
Great experience in Latin America with the black octagons. They work. Taking away these cartoon characters that are sort of polluting kids' minds about what's healthy and what's not. That's information. Also, dietary guideline committees, making sure they take on the issue of ultra-processing. And then the fourth thing is interest. Getting rid of conflicts of interest in terms of advisory committees to government, in terms of other bodies and researchers, actually. Researchers that are paid by industry to look at benefits or the harms of products will, not always, not every single one, but in the aggregate, will show a significant systematic bias towards the industry. So that has to be, science has to be independent, it's clear.
Another part of this ideal system is transparency. Gillespie believes that publicly available information needs to be a foundational component of the guidelines put in place. The company's lobbying practices and the reporting of their investment portfolios, sales, and marketing behaviors.
And then there's a revolving door between politicians and corporations that has to be stopped. You know, we can't have politicians choosing not to do anything about this problem because they see the potential of a nice job later on with Coca-Cola or Nestle. So I think all this has to be clarified in terms of the direction and not just the pledges and promises and commitments. We hear them all the time. Action, not words. And therefore, there has to be independent verification of the way in which portfolios and the investments are changing in companies to prioritize people and planet.
Some governments have begun to talk about this issue. In fact, the UK published a policy paper on a food strategy for England earlier this year. It aims to build a future where food is healthy, affordable, and accessible. However, this effort has included representatives from a few major food corporations, a choice that Gillespie says will reduce this plan into nothing more than another well-intentioned failure.
On the planning board, we have various large corporations sitting there, and they shouldn't be there. They shouldn't be on the planning strategy development. So we'll see. But some of the same old mistakes of the past seem to be there. But there's a lot of public demand now for much more transparency and accountability.
That doesn't mean there's no spot for industry at the table, but Gillespie argues that they shouldn't be involved until much later in the process.
You don't need industry there because industry will be, it's cross-purposes. You have two different purposes there. When you have two different purposes, you pollute the discourse. And the two different purposes are profit and health, if you like. And what we need is people around the table who have share the same purpose, same goal. Industry then can come in later to say, okay, once that's been decided what the strategy looks like, a set of actions to move in that direction, to implement the strategy, then you bring in industry, say, right, you can come in now, tell us how you as the industry can best implement or operate with these guidelines and these guardrails to ensure you can make some profit, but also ensure there's healthy and planetary and human is protected.
Despite the overwhelming presence of the current unrestricted system, Gillespie thinks that these parameters will be respected by industry. In fact, once there's a clear set of standards to work within, he believes the companies can once again flourish, just not at the expense of their consumers.
The thing that's happening now is innovation has been driven by the logic of the system that we've had so far. And that means innovation tends to be technological and it tends to be focused on maximizing profit. It's not about improving the healthiness. Once you reset the system, innovation follows a different logic. Innovation will have to say, okay, it could be social innovation, not just technological innovation. The innovation literally means something new that is beneficial. that will, again, move more towards people and planet, towards human health, towards planetary health than we've ever had before. They're good at that. They have the money to be able to move in that direction. They just don't have any incentives to do that right now because they're making a lot of money out of doing what they've done for the last 15 odd years.
One of the arguments against this innovation, especially in America, is freedom. If you want to eat ultra-processed food, that should be your decision, no matter how unhealthy it may be. But Gillespie counters that with the historical precedents for government interfering with personal freedom to protect large-scale public health.
Kids can't buy cigarettes. They can't buy alcohol. We have, you know, standards of sanitation. Of, you know, all these things have been done to protect public health. The same applies to a junk food, saturated food environment. And that's the role, and it's a large-scale issue, massive issue of human health. That's the role of the government to act to do that. And within that, industry will find its way to survive or not, perhaps. But that's the new world that we're all going to be living in. And it should be a better world with regard to the healthiness of our diets.
Aside from the UK's food strategy, other countries have begun to institute policies that are making progress.
In Chile, there was a great senator, Guido Girardi, who did great things and brought in the Black Octagon labels on harmful products or products high in fat, salt, and sugar. Colombia is the first country to bring in a junk food tax, not just a soda tax, but a junk food tax. The problem, and there, all the kind of actions that could be done and have been seen to be successful in different places could be brought together. And I do actually believe that 2 + 2 = 5 when you do this. You know, I think you'd get this interaction effect that is almost always positive. So on top, it's not just additive. So if you have 4 interventions, you do them all at once. It's not just the impact from the 4, you get something else. It's very rarely that you're going to get antagonistic sort of interactions. They're going to be positive interactions. So you have potential to move into from vicious cycles to virtuous cycles by doing things together.
So while we're still in the early days of building awareness and creating action, Gillespie is hopeful that we can shift the food industry and craft a system that works with consumers and upholds health standards.
I'm not advocating for banning ultra-processed food. It's about balance. And it will take a while to get there. I'm not naive enough to think these things happen overnight. But in the next 5 to 10 years, definitely we can see some real kind of traction.
Gillespie's book, Food Fight, is available now. You can find more information about Stuart Gillespie and all of our guests on our website, radiohealthjournal.org. Our writer-producer is Kristen Farah. Our production manager is Jason Dickey. I'm Greg Johnson.
Radio Health Journal returns in just a moment.
At Charmin, we heard you shouldn't talk about going to the bathroom in public, so we decided to sing about it.
Charmin Ultra Strong. You can use less, better than the rest. Charmin Ultra Strong.
Your booty past the clean tech. Yeah. Salmon wave texture, it's the best.
Study up, teach a lesson on fresh.
Your booty past the clean tech.
Yes, sir.
Charmin Ultra Strong.
Charmin Ultra Strong with Diamond Weave Texture cleans better than the leading one-ply brand, so you can use less. Enjoy the go with Charmin.
Maria, salon owner. You know the jingle. Now discover the facts about Ozempic, a GLP-1. There's only one FDA-approved Ozempic, made by Novo Nordisk. Learn about the real thing.
Talk to your healthcare professional today. Call 1-833-OZEMPIC or visit ozempic.com to view the medication guide and to learn more about Ozempic. Semaglutide injection 0.5, 1, and 2 milligrams.
At Skechers, comfort is a technology. That's right, it doesn't just happen. You don't just make a shoe and hope it comes out comfortable. It takes research, innovations, compounds, engineering, and so many of the boring things we don't really want to get into. Because it gives us time to talk about the exciting stuff, your comfort. You see, Skechers want you to feel so comfortable you swear you're wearing pillows on your feet. So we have features like Skechers Air Cool Memory Foam that molds to your foot and wraps it in luxury. And Skechers has fits like Relax Fit, Stretch Fit, Wide Fit, Arch Fit, and so many more. All comfort technologies that make the shoe feel like it was custom-made just for your foot. Plus, we have hands-free Skechers Slip-ins technology, and this, folks, is a game-changer. This tech allows you to just step into your shoes and put them on. You don't have to bend down and struggle. You don't even have to touch them. That's ultimate convenience and comfort. So you see, comfort is a technology. And nobody, and I mean nobody, does comfort like Skechers. The comfort technology company. Find yours at a Skechers store, Skechers.com, or wherever comfortable footwear is sold.
Medical notes this week. What's the best diet to boost brain function? A new study in the journal Metabolic Brain Disease reveals that following a low-carbohydrate or low-calorie meal plan was shown to improve brain metabolism in patients with early-stage fatty liver disease. Researchers found that just 2 weeks of this diet slowed cognitive decline and supported long-term brain function. The scientists are now conducting a larger clinical trial to see which dietary interventions make the biggest difference. A new test can reduce barriers to HPV treatment. Human papillomavirus, or HPV, is the greatest cause of cervical cancer. A high number of deaths from this cancer are attributed to delays in diagnosis and treatment. Thankfully, researchers have created a new test that provides accurate results within an hour, which helps clinicians begin treatment faster than ever. The study is published in the journal Nature Communications. Your hometown may be affecting your health. New research has found that where you live may increase your risk for psychotic disorders. A meta-analysis examined multiple countries and discovered that areas with lower income, high crime, and poor quality housing showed nearly 80% higher rates of mental illness. The research is published in the journal Social Psychiatry and Psychiatric Epidemiology. And finally, if you're looking for a boost in health and happiness, it may be time to tie the knot. A new study reports that single people in America and Japan have lower life satisfaction and health than married people. The data includes assessments of psychological and social factors over 2 decades. The findings appear in the journal Personal Relationships. And that's Medical Notes this week. I'm Mayan Vosta-Betancourt.
Oh, no.
Ah, that's the sound of someone who's misplaced...
My debit card.
Their debit card.
Where'd I leave that thing?
Not at the gas pump... or the checkout counter, or the roof of your car. Now, if he has the Chase mobile app, he can use Card Lock.
Wait, I could just lock my card.
Yep, just a few tippy taps on his phone, and that sound? That's peace of mind from Chase.
Chase mobile app is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JPMorgan Chase Bank N.A., member FDIC.
Behold the Colonel's giant KFC chicken sandwich, a towering extra crispy monument to flavor. Such a huge amount of juicy, hand-breaded KFC chicken at a pretty tiny $3.99 price. For the Colonel's KFC chicken sandwich. I mean, $3.99 isn't even worthy of the same epic soundtrack as the KFC chicken sandwich for only $3.99. The Colonel lived, so we could chicken.
Prices and participation vary while supplies last. Taxes, tips, and fees extra.
Thank you for joining us this week and every week as we break down the science stories you need to know. You can find all of our past segments and guests on our website, radiohealthjournal.org, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and X for daily content. And tune in next week for another edition of Radio Health Journal.
The right mix for Park Falls and Phillips. This is Trail Mix 103.1.
It's a death row pardon, 2 minutes too late. And isn't it ironic, don't you think? It's like rain on your wedding day. It's a free ride when you've already paid. It's the good advice that you just did. Listen. cigarette break. It's like 10,000 spoons when all you need is a knife.